Well, hi there, Kentucky Living Health Club members. Our interview this week is with Dr. Roger Landry, and he is the author of Live Long, Die Short, A Guide to Authentic Health and Successful Aging, which obviously fits perfectly with our theme for this year's Health Club. And let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Landry. He received his MD at Tufts University School of Medicine and his Master's in Public Health at Harvard University School of Public Health. He is currently the president of Masterpiece Living, a group of multidiscipline specialists in aging who partner with communities to assist them in becoming destinations for continued growth. Dr. Landry was a flight surgeon in the U.S. Air Force for over 22 years and retired as a highly decorated full colonel and chief flight surgeon at the Air Force Surgeon General's office in Washington, D.C. His work took place on five continents, and he was medically involved in a number of significant world events, including Vietnam, the Chernobyl nuclear disaster, the Beirut bombing of the Marine barracks, the first seven shuttle launches, and the first manned balloon crossing of the Pacific. He was a member of a group awarded a grant by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's Active Living by Design Initiative to make cities more healthy and livable. Welcome, Dr. Landry. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, Lisa, I'm honored. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, one of the things that I was really excited about the book is talking, well, many things, but the first thing I'd really like to cover is this idea of three characteristics that kind of define the term of successful aging, and also how that is related to how our ancestors lived and what we're kind of missing out on today by living in our modern society.
Oh yes, this is great stuff that I came to appreciate much more as in my journey in writing the book. Well, the MacArthur Foundation for 10 years studied what it was that made people age in a better way, stay at high levels of performance for longer periods of time, and with a higher quality of life and a shorter period of decline. And what they found changed our view of aging forever, that it was indeed lifestyle that was the major determinant, and they found that the three characteristics that you just spoke of seem to be in common with those who age successfully and actually define the term aging successfully. Well, those are first of all, that people who age successfully refuse to rust out. They challenge themselves physically and mentally. They know that this stereotype of aging as only about decline is false, and to the extent that we accept that and we don't endeavor to challenge ourselves physically and mentally, continue to, that we will indeed decline. But to the extent we do, just as when we were younger, we don't. We flourish. And what we know now about brain health, that our brain, we're the architect of our brain, and to the extent that we learn new things and take care of our brains, and that we can grow new brain tissue, that our brain can be as vital as it was decades ago and can continue as long as we have a pulse. And, of course, the physical part most of us know about.
Right.
Yes. The second thing is that they refuse to be victims, and you know, we're all at risk for something, either from our parents or how we lived before, and so we, to the extent you find out what those risks are and work with your doctor and find out what it is, what kind of lifestyle can reduce those risks, that's what will happen. It makes sense. It's not rocket science. We've learned a lot more in medicine, and you know, we can live many years, high quality of life with conditions that used to be lethal within months or terminal within months, like pancreatic cancer and those sort of very serious ones, but even some now that we can, like colon cancer, that we can absolutely never die of because it's a slow grower, we can detect it, and it's treatable. The third one was huge. And you know, I think you folks in Kentucky get this better than we do, where I'm from in New England, but that's about being socially connected. But what they found was a huge new finding at the time, and that is that people who are connected, and that was engaged in life, and that was defined as having a network of friends, being part of a community, and having meaning and purpose. So once again, to the extent that we allow ourselves as we age to be pasteurized, not like milk, like horses, so that our society for centuries now have taken their older adults and sort of marginalized them, put them out to pasture, and we did it for good reasons, but not realizing that that was maybe some of the worst things we could do. Because staying engaged, continuing to grow, being connected, having a role, having purpose, this was critical to aging successfully.
Right, and I guess people thought that older people needed to rest, when in fact that was totally the opposite they needed. They
didn't. It's true. Well, resting is deadly. So, but you know, it's also a question of continuing to grow as long as you have a pulse. Now, this all makes sense. You asked about our ancestors, and this,
yes,
I believe, is a huge thing that's being overlooked in our society today. Because if you look at the total time we've been on Earth and make it 1 year, 363 days of that, we lived in a totally different way, as hunter-gatherers or as agrarian society. And so we survived as a species because we developed certain characteristics and adaptations, and those were wired into our very DNA, and we still need them today to be healthy, and I call that to be authentically healthy. These are authentic needs that we have as humans. And our society has changed so rapidly in the last couple centuries since the Industrial Revolution that it's nowhere near the way we lived as the way our ancestors lived. And yet our physiologies have not changed that much, so that we are somewhat maladapted. But the characteristics of that society was that they moved a lot, they learned from their environment, or else if they didn't, they weren't going to survive. So they continued to learn throughout their lives. They ate differently. They ate fruits, nuts, vegetables, small amounts of meat, because large amounts weren't available. We ate small amounts, but ate throughout the day, radically different than we eat today. These people all had a role. They were socially connected, working for our common good and a higher purpose, and which was survival. They were close to nature. All of those things, and yet I think as I say these, you can see that we don't see as much of that in our society today, and hence a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And so how does one begin to start incorporating those characteristics back into a life? I loved your definition. I want to hear your definition of change, but what cracked me up in the book was where one of your headings was that folks suck at change. And I'd like to know how, I thought that was hilarious because it is true. As a wellness coach, I deal in behavior all the time, so I totally understand what you're talking about. So what is your definition of change, and how can we make changes that actually do stick? What's the trick?
Well, we have a problem in our society today that our ancestors didn't have. When our ancestors were confronted with change, large change, it usually meant a threat to their very survival, you know, large weather changes or food availability or some sort of foreign group coming in and taking their risk. Anyway, change became associated with a fear response. So we as humans still do that, and we can see that in our studies and brain scans. When someone is confronted with a major change, there's a certain area of the brain called the amygdala that is associated with generating a fear response. So the hormones and the neuroendocrine substance, the brain hormones, all these things are released, the adrenaline, and this is all meant to respond to a threat to your very life. So this is called the fight or flight mechanism. It creates tremendous amounts of stress, however, if it becomes a chronic thing. It was meant to just for survival. So when we're confronted with change, a large amount of change, we begin to worry about that. Can I do it? And by definition, as humans, it generates a fear response, which is great for fighting a tiger, but not necessarily for figuring out a good plan to change your lifestyle. So that's one thing. The second thing is that we as a society don't value small change, only large change. So here we have a condition that we respond to negatively when we're confronted with large change, and we only value large change. So that's why we suck at change. I don't use that word often, but I felt it was a good one for this. And so the New Year's resolution approach to change is just doomed. It is doomed to failure. And what happens, this is the worst part, is that we get discouraged. We lose our confidence in our ability to change and essentially give up and occasionally make some small attempts, but know in our heart of hearts we're probably not going to succeed at this or give up. And that's not the way it should be. Change is there's a Japanese approach to change, and it's outlined in a book by Robert Moorer called One Small Step Can Change Your Life. And they do something called Kaizen. It's a Japanese word, but basically they do change, approach change, in very small steps. And when you do it that way, you cannot fail. Mm-hmm. Say, for instance, you want to lose some weight, and you're not moving, you're not exercising, and you're overweight. So I have a physician friend who will advise the patient who comes in, and this is the problem. Say, okay, what I'd like for you to do is to stand for one television commercial an hour. Just stand mm-hmm. during that commercial. Can you do that? Oh, yeah, I can do that. And the person does that and comes back and says, I did it. Hey, I can do that. And they're beginning to feel confident. And then you get the story. It's just a gradual stand for two commercials, walk in place during commercials, and then eventually go take a walk for 4 minutes, for 5 minutes. And if for some reason that person doesn't achieve that, well, then they just took on too much of a goal, and you step back and you do that one. So that what's really happening is you're developing a competence and a confidence that you can change, and that is the gold in this in the hills, so to speak, that confidence. And so, again, it's about small changes. We can ultimately get to our goal. It just may take us a little longer. We have to be patient. But to try to grasp for the gold ring, brass ring, right away, we're more than likely doomed to failure and to give up. So there you go.
Right.
Cannot lose.
Yeah, absolutely. I preach a lot about baby steps and the idea that practice is progress. And so it was really nice to see you talk about that in your book, too, the baby steps and just slow, small changes a little bit at a time. So, that's how it works. The other thing that really struck me, and I think that people, as they start to get older, they are really concerned about this idea that they lose their value in society, especially in our society. And I know you're really passionate about the idea that people can and should still have purpose and passion as they age and still contribute value to their communities and society at large. In fact, you're even suggesting that people get involved at a political level to try to change the way society and our government looks at aging people. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. The group I work with, Masterpiece Living, that you mentioned earlier, we partner with communities, but our ultimate goal is to develop compelling arguments with data that show when people are able to live a certain lifestyle or that it's facilitated and they are engaged, that they will age in a better way. So this dates back once again to our ancestors. Up until the Industrial Revolution, which was very recent, actually, only a couple hundred years, and in that 1 year of time I talked about earlier, that's about a day ago. The elders really ran the show. They were the guiding force in civilizations and societies and tribes and cities. And it was only at the Industrial Revolution that began to change, and our older adults have become somewhat marginalized and pasteurized, I like to say, like horses. So it's then becomes a stereotype that at some age, some magical age, which 65 or whatever it is, it's ridiculous because we're not any different the day after that birthday, that we sort of begin to have a role of just kicking back, comfort, security, recreate, and that's all good, but it's not enough for a human to age successfully. We must, as you heard from the MacArthur Foundation, stay engaged and with purpose. So it's not just a matter of older adults being marginalized and saying, hey, we want to be able to live a lifestyle and pay attention to us and don't treat us as just accounts payable or we just want entitlements. We want to be treated with respect. That is all a good argument, but there's also the other side, that older adults must continue to give back to the society, to contribute, and to give the experience, the benefit of their experience and guidance to society. We as a society, on the other hand, must realize that we cannot afford to throw away this valuable resource that we have in our older adults, the experience, the judgment, the wisdom, and we essentially just throw it away. And as we age as a society, that's going to become very clear, but we have to, we can't wait till then. I think we have to earlier. So to the extent that policymakers understand that people can age in a better way, that we can limit the time that we're declining and therefore save healthcare costs, beyond that, we can tap into this wisdom and experience there in some way, some creative way, so that they continue to keep our society on the rails, so to speak, keep you from coming off the rails, because some of us seeing these days, you know, no matter what. And so it's a two-way street, in other words. Stay engaged. You can demand it, but we also have to, as older adults, give back so that society benefits and everyone benefits from it.
Right, exactly. You know, the other, one other little piece that you had talked about that I wanted to touch on, if we have just a couple more minutes, would be the idea that how folks in this baby boomer age range, how it's going to look different. I think you mentioned, one of the things you mentioned in the book was that senior centers aren't going to be called senior centers anymore, that maybe these baby boomers kind of view aging differently too. Is that also part of a good thing, or how do you see that?
Absolutely. This stereotype of aging as decline is comes with a whole language and semantics that that are not flattering to aging and to older adults. The communities we work, in fact, after they have met a few criteria, become certified centers for successful aging. So rather than be called a retirement community or a senior center, these places can be, again, centers for successful aging. That's only one example of much of the words that we use that we have to change in order to change this whole stereotype of aging as decline.
Yeah, it's really exciting, a really exciting book. And so, folks, our members of the Kentucky Living Health Club, I know that we're going to be giving one of these books away as a weekly prize, but if you're not the winner this week, you need to visit livelongdieshort.com, all one word, livelongdieshort.com. I'll be posting a link for that. Also, you can also access this book on Amazon.com. So, Dr. Landry, I just want to thank you so much for being with us today. It has been a pleasure.
My pleasure, Lisa. I appreciate this conversation. I've enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Thank you. And Kentucky Living Health Club members, I'll be talking with you next week. Thanks so much.